In the news.
Welcome, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. So for today, we actually have three topics we want to cover. So starting off with the 2016 election, again, the election that will never end. I know Hillary Clinton is thinking that. Then we'll talk a little more about Hillary Clinton, specifically her trouble with her email server. Again, she's not sending out crazy tweets, but oh, what she did with her server. Then finally, we'll move on to everybody's favorite topic, Obama's executive actions. Now, again, I know this is titled American and Texas Government. We'll get to Texas probably a little bit more next week. But again, we will mention Texas because when we talk about Obama's executive actions, oh, Texas plays a very key role in that. But I want to start off again with the 2016 election, especially the primary, and really talk about what we're seeing taking shape.
Well, we kind of thought at this point that things would be concluded. Yeah. I mean, you know, I started my class last semester in the winter, and, you know, in January 15th, January 20th, and, you know, I just can't believe by May, you know, the Democrats, you know, the two parties of the Democrats would be the one that would still have a contest waging on and on and on. Hillary Clinton can't be real thrilled about this, but, you know, Bernie Sanders is the candidate who won't go away. He's the guest you invite for dinner and doesn't seem to ever want to leave. We want to talk a little bit, though, as we set this thing up. Let's take a step back. Let's talk about this sort of process generally, and then we'll hone in on some of the specific elements of it that kind of animate a lot of the conversation, a lot of the discussion we've been having recently. So if we go to slide one, let's start from the very beginning. Let's talk just a few numbers as we set this thing up. You notice from the slide, it has the total number of delegates that you need to nominate. Now, this is on the Democratic side. On the Democratic side. So you see the number that you need is 2,383 delegates. Where does that number come from? You got me. The Democrats have always had more total delegates than the Republicans. I don't know why. They just seem to have, you know, a need for more hotel space, I suppose, when they're having their conventions. And you'll notice also a couple things. One is that Hillary Clinton, as you look at that sidebar, is very close to the total that she needs. Right? So she's pushed well up over 2,200 at this point. She needs 2,383. And you'll also know, and Bernie Sanders over there to the right, you know, not doing too bad. He's over 1,500, but he's well short of the 2,383 that he needs to win the nomination. You'll also notice a distinction in the bars, right? We've got in the light blue the pledged delegates. Those are the delegates that you actually win by winning over voters in primaries and caucuses. And then you've got that darker blue number, the superdelegates. And we'll talk about those and who they are and what their magical powers are in a little while. But you'll notice the discrepancy there, right? In pledged delegates, Hillary Clinton has 541 pledged delegates. People who've said, you know, who have positions at the convention who say, we're going to vote for Hillary. Bernie's only got 43. And this is something that's led to a lot of, you know, hand-wringing on the part of the Sanders supporters. You know, the system is rigged. We've got all sorts of problems with this. You know, it's not fair, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's the Democratic side of things. She's very, very close. He's not so close, despite the fact that they've kind of gone back and forth in winning states. Right? We'll talk a little bit about that. Let's just go to slide two real quick, just for comparative purposes. We'll talk a lot about the Republicans later on this semester. We're not interested in them so much right now. On the Republican side, you notice again up at the top, 1,237 delegates needed to nominate. The Republicans just have fewer total delegates. The delegates, by the way, come from the states. So states determine processes that fix how and when and who gets selected as delegates. On the Republican side, the magic number is 1,237. A couple things to note between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump, already has, according to Associated Press reports, 1,239 delegates. So he's two over the top, according to those counts. And he's still got New Jersey, California, a couple other places to pick up some additional breathing room, I guess. So this is why we say Donald Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee. You notice down there lurking in the far right is John Kasich with 161. We put him there just because he was one of the last three standing. Professor McDaniel pointed out to me a little earlier, Marco Rubio actually has more than 161, but, you know, we took out Marco here. Somebody had to go. Cruz with about 560. So they'll take those delegates to the convention, but the Republican race, for all intents and purposes, is over. So we go back to slide one, though, our focus on the Democratic side. That race is still active, right? And a lot of the focus has been Sanders doesn't seem to have a mathematical shot at winning, but he continues to run. All right. Now, I wanted to spend, so that's the math. That's kind of where we are right now. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about this process in historical terms. It's not something that's existed since the founding of the Republic. All right. A couple points. The first is, these are political parties determining their nominees. All right. This is these are private groups in some sense. You know, the government doesn't control political parties. There's some regulation. But these are private associations, and they can choose their nominees however they want. Now, historically, what's happened, the parties, and we'll talk a lot about this later in the semester, sort of develop in the 1820s and 1830s and 40s, national conventions, nominating conventions, come to pass in the 1830s and 1840s. Since that time, up until about, let's say, 1968 or so, the states would determine how their delegates were selected, and they would send a group of delegates to the national convention. More often than not, those delegates would be selected at a state convention, and the state parties controlled that process. Were there primaries and caucuses, you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s? Yeah, but they were mostly beauty contests. That is to say, you'd have a vote, and, you know, the state convention could take into account the preferences of the voters or not. Sometimes the states wouldn't even determine who they were supporting before they sent their delegations. They would go unpledged, and they would basically kind of wheel and deal at the national convention. So that was more or less the process until the early 1970s, right? There was a meltdown Democratic convention in 1968. There were lots of problems with that convention, and it led to changing the system. So the current presidential nominating system was really kind of pioneered by the Democrats after 68. And the Republicans sort of followed suit. That process, it's still the case that the states have a large control, over how they get their delegations together and send them to the national convention. But what the states have basically done is they've turned that process over to the voters. So if you're asking, why does the Iowa caucus matter? Why does the New Hampshire primary, the Texas primary matter? It's because since the 1970s, the states have basically said, our delegations are going to be determined by the outcome of primaries and caucuses, elections. Right? That's kind of where we are right now. So I want to point out to everybody that basically we've only had, you could argue about whether 72 or 76 is the first primary caucus-dominated process. I'd probably go 76. If you count from 1976, we've had 10 elections with this new system in place. And this new system, we don't know, it changes every 4 years. The states change their rules. You know, different sides have different practices. There's different elections in different states. They change the timing of when the elections are. All this stuff matters. As political scientists, we're still grappling with how it goes down. And do we have any theories for how this happens? Broad kind of meta understandings? Not really. You know, it's one of those things that I think we kind of lag behind the curve a little bit, and they keep changing the rules on us. So what we think we know kind of dissipates from year to year. So we're still playing a little bit of catch up. All right, so I'm sure that's a little more history than you wanted, but if you're kind of baffled by what the heck is going on in 2016, we are too. It's again, kind of a new-ish process, and does it make much sense to have different contests under different rules in different states at different times and aggregate the results? No, but it's just sort of a historical artifact. And, you know, it's something that, again, we're still grappling with, you know, really on a case-by-case basis. All right, so, but let's talk a little bit about, since this has been a, you know, kind of a focal point of criticism, let's talk a little bit about the superdelegates. So, Professor McDaniel, you love superdelegates, right?
Oh, superdelegates are, you know, those are my people. So they get to wear...
It's a physical strength thing, right? Isn't that, unless you can bench press 250 pounds, you're not a superdelegate.
Yeah, I don't know if Debbie Wasserman Strauss can do that, but you never know. She's from Florida. She may have wrestled gators growing up. But superdelegates, they get to wear a cape when they show up to the primary convention, but the superdelegates are really important. The superdelegates are those who have elected office, usually at the state, local, or national level, and have some power within the party. So the reason why they're called superdelegates is because they have some high level of power within the party, either by being elected or been actively involved in the party. Now, what's important to understand here is that Hillary Clinton has, again, greater than 10-1 margin in regards to superdelegates compared to Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie Sanders supporters are saying, well, no, this shows it's rigged. Here's the thing we need to remember. Bernie Sanders became a Democrat a year ago, all right? Hillary Clinton has been active with the Democratic Party for decades. Plus, Hillary Clinton's also been referred to as the Suge Knight of the Democratic Party, so you don't mess with Suge. But at the same time, that's one of the things we need to be aware of, is when it comes to actually raising money, things like that, you know, Hillary Clinton's been doing that work. Bernie Sanders has been an independent. And so the idea that Bernie Sanders, in many people's eyes, is kind of barged into the party and is like, hey, where's my support, is troubling, especially to those who are established. And so, yes, he is the anti-establishment candidate because he wasn't even part of the establishment. So it's one of these weird things that's going on. But these superdelegates are extremely important because the superdelegates, many people argue, kind of undercut the democratic process of the primaries, because what you're doing is you're allowing these certain individuals to basically do whatever they please. And this has been one of the things where early on the Sanders supporters were going after the superdelegates, saying you're rigging this, you're going to steal the election away from Bernie. To now Bernie saying, oh no, we're going to recruit them. So we may not win in terms of we may not win in the primaries, but we'll win those superdelegates. And so it's one of these things where if you have them, you love them. If you don't, you hate them. So think of it as a I guess like a high school girls frenemies type thing. So, you know, think of it those ways in terms of how they treat the superdelegates. So they're with Hillary now. Hillary loves them. But 8 years ago, oh, she couldn't stand these people when they were all supporting Obama. So many of the tactics you're seeing going on with Sanders, you saw going on with Clinton 8 years ago. So this is nothing new. The loser always cries foul and says that it's rigged against me.
That's right. Process is the last refuge of scoundrels. I think what we'd like to do is plug in now to SNL had a nice cold open, I think basically characterizes the state of the race kind of moving into the New Jersey and California primaries. So if we could roll that video.
Well, bartender, I've done it. I've won the nomination. I mean, no, I haven't. I keep losing states. But mathematically, I've done it to math. All right, I think I'm going to head home. Don't you work too late now.
Oh, I won't, Mrs. Clinton. I'm actually closing up the bar right now. So everybody's got to go. That means you too, sir.
No freaking way. I'm not going anywhere. I can stay here as long as I want.
Senator Sanders, I'm sorry, but the night is over.
No, it's not over. It's not over till I say it's over.
Oh, hello, Bernie. I didn't see you sitting behind me. So far behind me, you can never catch him.
Oh, shut up. You saw me. You even see me in your sleep, baby. Because I'm your worst nightmare.
Oh, please. My worst nightmare is a mandatory spa day, and you know it.
Mine is waiting over an hour at LensCrafters.
Oh, Bernie, it's always so just fine to see you. I love your suit, by the way. Looks old. Mm.
And I love your suit. Looks like you were just elected to the Galactic Council.
Excuse me, bartender. Do you mind if I just have one more drink with my old, very old, kind of dangerously old friend, Bernie?
Sure, Mrs. Clinton. What can I get for you two?
I'll have a beer. A new brand that people are flocking to. Something refreshing and revolutionary. Something that draws huge crowds.
And I'll have whatever beer no one likes but gets the job done. Now, Bernie, you should be proud, you know? You ran a damn good campaign.
I'm running a good campaign.
But don't worry. I promise I'm going to have a very special role for you in my administration. How would you like to be, wait for it, the senator from Vermont?
Oh, Hillary, I'll miss that lack of charm.
I'll miss your deal, too. But I have to move on, and that's why I've started pivoting to the general.
Yeah, I gotta say, I've noticed the pivot. Not a fan of the pivot. Way too early for the pivot.
What is it? Why do you keep saying pivot? What is that?
Here are your drinks. And whose bill should I put this on?
Mine. Well, Bernie, no matter what happens, you got to admit, we've had some good times, you and I.
Yeah, it's true. Remember when I told everyone to stop talking about your damn emails? What a schmuck!
That could have taken me down!
I know! I'm so stupid! So stupid!
I do not like humor, but that was funny. Oh my gosh! And remember all those states like Wyoming, where you beat me by a lot, but then I still got most of the delegates?
Oh my god! That was so stupid! It's rigged!
I know, it's so rigged!
Oh my god! To Debbie Wasserman Schultz!
To Debbie!
Woo! Listen, Hillary. This might be the beer talking.
Yeah.
But can I tell you a secret?
Okay.
You know how I constantly rail against the upper class?
Yes.
Well, sometimes when I go to sleep at night, I dream about being a fancy millionaire or billionaire.
Really?
Yeah. And in my dream, I wear a fancy hat. I say fancy things like, I'll have a tuna sandwich. On a croissant. Oh.
Can I tell you a secret?
Sure.
I've never told anyone this, but you know the presidency?
Yeah.
I really, really want it.
You don't say.
Yeah, and you know what else? I don't really like people. I only talk to them because I want to be the president so bad. Please, don't tell. Don't tell.
I think they know.
Oh, Bernie, you know, we are mortal enemies, but I really admire you. So what do you say? Will you dance with me?
I'm not gonna dance with you. I don't do that. I'm not gonna dance.
I'll give you 3 superdelegates.
Yeah, let's dance. All right. Yeah. And, I'll leave.
Never.
Couple small points. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the head of the Democratic National Committee, and she's been kind of a Hillary backer from day one, so that's the inside joke there. And you saw a couple references, or heard a couple references to superdelegates. So the next 2 contests that are going to be up next Tuesday are a New Jersey primary, and then you've got the California primary. And Hillary will probably go over the top officially with the New Jersey primary, and she'll probably make her speech immediately after that, because that'll be something like a primetime speech. She doesn't want to wait till 11 o'clock Eastern time when California gets done. Plus, she could lose California. Professor McDaniel and I were talking a little bit about the demography of the vote, and just so you guys are kind of aware of these things, basically Bernie's been, you know, killing it with young people, because, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds really love a 73-year-old Vermont Democratic Socialist, apparently. Be that as it may, Hillary is doing really well with African Americans, to a slightly lesser extent, Hispanics. She does better with seniors.
Yeah.
There's not much of a gender gap, really, which you might assume there is, and there probably will be in the general, but there's not much of one in the primary. Women don't disproportionately support her. She's got a little bit of an edge there, but not all that much.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders is Drake. Hillary Clinton is Al Green.
I like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's
Al Green is love.
Yeah, that's right. Again, when you become a middle-aged black man, for some reason, Al Green sounds so much better. But this, I mean, this is really the thing that's been sticking out is, you know, Hillary Clinton, even though people say she is not personable, has really done, really been active in reaching out to the African-American community, keeping them mobilized, whereas Bernie Sanders really kind of jumped on, kind of came a little bit late. I mean, again, he's from Vermont, and I think at one point Vermont was rated as the whitest state in America, so the idea of actively dealing with African-American issues. I think he deals more with French-Canadian issues than African-American issues in Vermont.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think, you know, the consensus is that there's an appreciable minority population in a state. Hillary does better and better the larger that percentage is. We wanted to transition to our second topic today, which is Hillary's emails and her server. And, you know, you heard it referenced in the SNL skit. Professor McDaniel and I would offer to y'all that if there are two things that have really hurt Hillary Clinton as she matches up potentially with Donald Trump in a general election. The first is her inability to subdue Bernie Sanders and actually win the nomination. The second is this persistent email and server issue that cropped up when she was Secretary of State. We have a video that kind of describes the most recent turn of events here and gives you a little bit of background. Let's see if we can roll that right now.
The Clinton campaign is in full damage control mode tonight. The candidate herself is finally coming out to respond and frankly spin the State Department Inspector General's report into something more of a slap on the wrist instead of a knockout punch, with, of course, an FBI investigation still pending. Senior political correspondent Mike Emanuel is with the Clinton team in San Jose, California tonight.
It took Hillary Clinton more than 24 hours to respond to the State Department's internal watchdog report that was critical of her use of a private email server.
It was allowed, and the rules have been clarified since I left about the practice. Having said that, I have said many times it was a mistake, and if I could go back, I would do it differently.
Reporters had tried asking her about the report, but she ignored the question.
Secretary Clinton, any response to the IG report?
Clinton initially left those questions for her campaign press secretary to handle.
Hillary Clinton has answered a lot of questions about it. There's really no new information that came to light in this report. The use of personal email by officials at the State Department was allowed.
Instead, Clinton is trying to fire up union support, saying this is a make-or-break election.
So to everyone who has faced hostile management, a hostile legislature, a union busting governor or all three, help is on the way.
The latest poll from Public Policy Institute of California reveals Clinton's lead in the Golden State has evaporated. She was up 7 percentage points over Sanders in March, and now it's Clinton 46, Sanders 44, within the poll's margin of error. Sanders appears to be feeling it.
On June 7th, let this great state tell the world you are prepared to go forward with a political revolution.
Sanders has also come out strongly in favor of California's adult use of marijuana initiative.
I personally believe that legalizing marijuana is the right thing to do.
And now the Clinton campaign is being forced to advertise in California. It's expected to be a six-figure ad buy starting tomorrow in response to Sanders spending $1.5 million to drive home his message.
You have the power to choose a new direction for the Democratic Party.
Don't do anything that's just not...
The Clinton team is downplaying the need for her to win California, noting she should have enough delegates after New Jersey's primary. But they clearly don't want Sanders, saying he's the one with momentum heading into the July convention. Brett? Mike Emanuel, live at a Clinton event in San Jose. Mike, thank you.
Now, before we go into the issues with Hillary Clinton and her server, I do have a question about Bernie Sanders and his support of legalizing pot. I think we really need to look into see to what degree did he receive donations from Frito-Lay. Because really, I think, you know, who's going to benefit from the munchies the most? Frito-Lay, Hostess, we need to look into that. Bernie, man of the people. I think Bernie might be a corporate stooge.
I think we found out the source of Bernie Sanders' appeal with young people. You know, it goes back to my 2008, you know, phraseology, you know, smoke dope, vote hope. So Bernie's got his issue. On the email server, let's break this down real quickly. There are two elements to it. When Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State in 2009, you know, she decided to do two things. She decided to use her own personal email account to handle incoming emails rather than the government account. And then she also decided to move all of her personal email correspondences onto a private server, which was housed at a compound in Colorado. And there's been a lot of controversy over this when the story first broke. Was this appropriate? Was this a security risk? And the Clinton people have basically sort of pushed back saying, you know, other secretaries of state have done it. They've noted that Colin Powell had a private email. Didn't have a server, but had a private email account. They said that John Kerry did it. Well, the Inspector General's report, the Inspector General is from the State Department, so it's an internal investigation. And the Inspector General really kind of came out with a fairly scathing report and said that, in fact, it is true that Colin Powell used a personal email account, but that was before, you know, the State Department had sort of the capacity to deal with all of the emails that they now do. So it wasn't that unusual. Secretary Kerry's barely used a personal account and only for personal emails. So they've pushed back a little bit on some of the things that have been prominent in the Clinton defense. Why do we care about this? What's interesting? Well, people will argue that it speaks to a sort of secrecy and a lack of transparency, a desire to kind of keep her stuff off the grid. And when you're Secretary of State, that can be arguably a dangerous thing. You know, that if you've got a personal email account and a server, it could get hacked. It's not subject to the sorts of security guidelines and standards that the government stuff is. And so, and then there's been her response. So that's kind of the source of this controversy. The FBI is conducting an investigation and will issue recommendations on this. It's possible the FBI could recommend indicting former Secretary Clinton. Unlikely, but it's possible. But I guess maybe more for our purposes, can we go to the slide that shows when this story broke, which was really, you know, spring of last year, Hillary Clinton was kind of a break-even candidate. She wasn't particularly liked or disliked, and that's pretty good for someone who's been in the public eye as long as she has. So you got her favorability numbers. Generally speaking, do you feel favorably towards Hillary Clinton or unfavorably? And she was -4, but, you know, right around break-even. 1 year later, all the drip, drip, drip from this email and server controversy, she's now 24 points underwater, as we say, 61% unfavorable. And that's something that's just been a drag on her. And maybe even more specifically, her honesty and trustworthiness numbers are really in the tank. And that's just very difficult to overcome as a general election candidate running for president, where you want people to trust you and have confidence in you. So
this is the same problem she was plagued with in 08. I mean, in 08, the trustworthiness was there. I mean, if you think about it in this sense, she was a Cubs fan until all of a sudden Bill Clinton's out of the White House, she moves to New York. I'm a Yankees fan. Come on now.
Yeah, that was reprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, we don't do those things. She's gotten in trouble for that. Like, can we really trust? A lot of people said, like, as a person, she's actually a great person, just a horrible candidate. And this is problematic for her. They said one-on-one, she's great. I mean, there are tons of stories they've told about one-on-one, especially with dealing with black women, that's really been coming out of the mothers of gun violence. But as a candidate, she just does not seem to care that off very well. And this has become problematic. She tried to use the I'm a grandmother thing. And then the, the suits are actually kind of interesting. Because I remember the first time she wore the big yellow one when she was debating Bernie Sanders. And I was like, wow, you're going to fight socialism by being dressed as a yellow version of Chairman Mao. That's really not going to work. But she is fighting this image problem. And to some degree, it's her fault. To some degree, it might be other things. But it's something that's plagued her for really the past, I want to say, close to 2 decades now.
You know, I think I'll just make sort of an editorial comment. And the fact is, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're wrong. And there's an element of that with respect to Hillary and the server and the emails. I mean, my sort of guess is that she moved a lot of this stuff offline because she thought that people were, Republicans and the media were going to FOIA, as we say, Freedom of Information Act. That's FOIA. People are going to file all these Freedom of Information Acts on everything she did as Secretary of State, and she was not going to be able to control her correspondences, and it was going to be a never-ending source of problems. I think that's probably why she made this decision in the first place. But that comes with the risk.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, so like I said, I do think that Hillary, probably because of her experience in the White House and her experience as a senator from New York, has a certain amount of paranoia with respect to the Republicans and the media. I think in some sense that's understandable, but does that justify essentially flouting you know, State Department directives on this. And you know, she basically made a calculated gamble, and I think this is sort of the fallout from that gamble. Still not clear to me it was a bad gamble. I mean, it's not totally clear. It's hurt her irreparably, but it's in the news.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she was of the belief it's easier to say I'm sorry than to ask for permission.
I think that's right.
Because she didn't ask for permission.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think that was made abundantly clear.
All right, we'll hit our last topic here. Not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's kind of ongoing, right?
Yeah.
Right? And that's President Obama in the last year of his two terms in office doing a little bit of legacy building. He's trying to get stuff done in the face of a Republican Congress that doesn't want to help him do anything. And the primary mechanism that the president has used to try to achieve things is by issuing executive orders, right, which aren't laws. They're kind of commands within the executive branch, by doing a lot of kind of extra congressional sorts of activities. You know, we can talk about things like opening up Cuba, a deal, an executive agreement with the Iranians on the nuclear program, things like raising the minimum wage for federal employees. And most recently, and I guess what sparked Professor McDaniel and I's interest in this topic today, is there was a regulation passed, or a change in the regulations regarding overtime pay for federal employees and people related to the federal branch. And so, you know, we wanted to just say a few things more generally, I guess, about, you know, this sort of conflict. And President Obama's kind of moving around Congress. I think he's just gotten so frustrated dealing with the Republican Congress that, you know, he's decided it's easier to issue executive orders and to, I guess in the case of, for instance, the other prominent example would be immigration law. Basically to claim that, well, you know, there's a lot of interpretive freedom when it comes to, you know, enacting a congressional law, right? So, I mean, we've seen this in healthcare, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this he's saying, you know, you don't want to help, I'm going to do something and we'll let the courts decide. And that's the courts are dealing with the, I know, with the immigration, so several things dealing with the ACA.
Affordable Care Act.
And so the president is basically saying, you know what, I want to make these changes, you don't want to work with me, I'll do something. And it's an interesting gamble because Senator Obama complained about the overuse of power of President Bush. Now that he's President Obama, he's realizing I'm going to use as much power as possible. So it's one of these things, like where you stand depends on where you sit. But this also bodes, is very important for who comes next in the White House. So how much power do you want to put in the hands of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump when they get into the White House? And so you may want to curb the power of Congress, I mean, of the president. And let's also be clear that it's not just the issue of a Democratic president versus Republican Congress. If we had a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, Congress would still be pushing back on the powers of the president because Congress itself does not want its legitimacy decreased because of the president's actions. So part of this is a partisan fight, but it's also a fight between institutions over who is most powerful in dictating the policies and the actions of the government.
Right. I mean, this is a, you know, classic point, right? We're going to be talking a lot about you know, the Constitution and the prescribed powers that go to the legislature, the Congress, to the executive, the president. And over time, and we'll hit on this a lot in the lecture modules, over time it's really been the case that the president has kind of gradually increased his power relative to the Congress. But it's the Congress in Article 1 that sort of has most of the power. And so Republicans, as the majority party in Congress, are kind of whining a lot about this now, about President Obama going well beyond what he has prescribed powers as per Article 2 of the Constitution. You know, but Professor McDaniel's point is exactly right. It's not a partisan thing. You know, when you occupy the White House, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you tend to get a fairly expansive view of executive powers. And when you don't occupy the White House, suddenly you're a strict constructionist and think that, well, we need to go back to limited powers and congressional sort of supremacy that you see prescribed in the Constitution. So, but it has been interesting. And as President Obama has tried to burnish his legacy, to try to get stuff done, he's been very expansive in his interpretation of what the rights the executive has to interpret laws. You know, the Republicans will say President Obama's making laws up without congressional authorization. What the defenders of the president would say is that, no, he's simply interpreting laws, and he has that authority as president of the United States. So, and again, the examples are on immigration, you know, on the Health Care Act, on some of these issues involving minimum wage and overtime laws, on environmental standards in the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. So the president hasn't gone to Congress and sort of initiated legislation much lately. you know, he's mostly just, you know, kind of stayed within the executive branch and operated there, right? And that's probably what we'll get for the next year.
Yeah.
You know? All right.
Yeah, so we got until, I guess, early January. So expect fun. So that is all we have for this week. And we'll, again, next week we'll cover on some more issues, probably talk a little more of the Supreme Court and some of the things going on in Texas. Because, again, these executive orders do affect the state of Texas. And you are seeing Texas fighting back actively in the courts against the federal government, which is kind of the way things go in Texas. If you ain't suing the federal government, what are you doing in Texas? But we'll see you all next week. Have a good week.
Take care.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.